Hello and welcome back to The Dorothy Project, the interview podcast celebrating women's impact on queer culture. My name's Alice Beverton-Palmer and I'm very excited to be back with season three after quite the hiatus. This season was recorded in the summer of 2021, so it has taken a little bit of time to reach you. You know how it is, when the COVID rates are down, we all want to be out enjoying the world, and when the COVID rates are up, well, I can barely focus on brushing my teeth, let alone podcasting. But in the words of Stephen Sondheim, I'm still here. And thank God, the Dorothy team has grown and we now have a new producer, Laura Blake. This very excitingly means that the podcast is sounding slightly more polished and I'm getting slightly more sleep. This season we have some amazing guests for you and I can't wait for you to meet them. First up, it's Bishi. If you're not yet familiar with her work, Bishi is a true Renaissance woman. She found herself on the London queer scene at a very young age and became part of legendary club kid Lee Bowery's band, Minty. Bishi has since created music across a dizzying array of instruments and genres and written powerfully about her experience of being a British Asian woman in the music industry. I know you'll love her as much as I did.
The Dorothy Project with Alice Beverton-Palmer.
How have you been?
Yeah, good. Enjoying the summer, just getting back into it, getting back into everything being open again.
I know, it's
such a treat.
It's strange, isn't it? Because it's we've essentially been in a sort of imprisoned, so it takes a bit of time to readjust and find your way around and everything that you thought was normal, because we're so used to everything all at once and then everything was taken away and then you realize actually you can readjust. And then I thought, oh, the clubs are going to reopen, I'm going to be a slag, and then they did, and I'm a bit like, do you know what I mean?
I do, and I keep forgetting that I can do things. Like, I keep forgetting that things are open, and it's like almost like the rhythms of life. I've just fallen out of it and I need to like get back in. You've been super creative over the past 18 months. So you've released a single, you've worked with a mixed reality company. You've done a lot in kind of VR and AR. Like, what's been sparking your creativity in this time?
Well, I think the need to not go mad, and also practical, you know, really practical things about just keeping my label, keeping my business going. So there was that. And then the gift of a lot of opportunities coming my way. And I think one of my talents is to make good out of a difficult situation. I think that's how I started my career. That's kind of been my life ethos, is, you know, I'm not happy with what my life is, or I'm not happy with where I am, or I feel isolated, or I'm in a bad situation. How do I make the best of a bad situation? And that's been my modus operandi for such a long time that I thought, well, this is my life skill and this can kick in now. And I know that by self-producing my own work, my own content, my own music, things kind of come to me that way.
I love that, like, through line and the fact that you can kind of identify that. That's really special. Yeah. And you wrote, actually, it was basically a year after the pandemic, I think, in March, a really powerful piece for the Musicians Union about being a woman of colour in music. For those who didn't get to read it, like, what would you say the situation kind of currently is, and what needs to be done?
Well, down to the uprising of Black Lives Matter, which came out of the tragic, tragic murder of George Floyd, the entire world's subconscious has changed. And I think the pandemic in itself has exposed huge inequalities for us all, you know, wherever we are in society. You know, freelancers fell into the gaps. People of university age are, you know, were being, you know, confined into their awful university halls with out-of-date food being brought to them in boxes. You know, that the inequality of society at large has really been exposed. And so the subconscious of the entire world has changed, which is quite extraordinary. And people are realizing that they, you know, they're looking at their boards, they're looking at their rosters, they're looking at the lay of the land and realizing that it's very undiverse. And so as somebody who's been ploughing her own field for a long time, all of a sudden I have all of this experience and I'm able to articulate what that feels like and what goes on. And so this has been my chance to really turn around and say things. You know, I'm Generation Y. So an analog childhood with a digital teenage years. So I have a very good understanding of shifting landscapes, and I understand technology, I understand the internet, I understand how one has to update oneself onto the new platforms. And so I feel able to give a point of view which is quite different from maybe, you know, further down into the millennial, zennial, Gen Z generation. I have a very unique perspective as someone who's been in the game independently for a while. And I've got into doing a lot of mentoring. I've got into doing a lot of advising and helping people to see a different perspective, but while saying to them, you know, you're not wrong. Like, people aren't wrong if they don't understand somebody's perspective. That doesn't make them evil or bad. You know, we can use the commonality of our experience to come together to build better futures for all creative people. So it's been a great space to step into and hopefully lend a hand to some people.
I think that's such a good point. And that's something that I definitely struggle with, is meeting people where they are and kind of figuring out, you know, how you get them to a place where everyone's on the same page about really difficult issues. That's a really difficult thing to do. And I think something that it feels like the world has been very divided for quite a long time now. But on the digital point and your kind of your position in that, like, so you run Witchy. So tell me about all of that, because that is super digital.
So some people say Witchy, I say Witch. I like it when people say Witchy. So Witch is the Women in Technology Creative Industries Hub, and it was a platform that I set up in 2016 to elevate the voices of women, trans and non-binary in tech. I started it up because my second album had drawn to a finale at Queen Elizabeth Hall, and it was a one-woman projection show. And I realized that there was this polymath creator emerging who was unrepresented, underrepresented, and needed to be in a space where people needed to be around like-minded people. So I combined my early experiences, my teenage experiences in LGBTQ plus scenes in London, where I started DJing and hosting when I was 16. So I combined that knowledge and that training of scene building and just applied it back to a bunch of producers and coders and creators. I've hosted various events, salons. I've set it up as a commissioning platform. And in June 2021, we had our second festival, which we call Witch Digital. It was completely digital. And I commissioned 5 new pieces of work, and we had 3 panels. And our star panelist was Laurie Anderson on the final night. So that was a big dream come true. And she was everything. And they're all up on our YouTube channel to watch. And it was a real celebration of where we are now technologically, and it was just 2 to 3 weeks before restrictions were lifted. So I got everybody at a really special moment when, like, everybody was like just coming to the end and kind of entering a new phase. But yeah, it was extraordinary to get the funding to do that. It was extraordinary that everybody that I asked to be involved said yes. And as you know, because you're in production as well, you know that everything is just about people's timings aligning. And that's why you just have to be brave and ask people, because on the off chance that all of your calendars sync up and everybody is into the idea and, you know, you can sort out all of the pragmatic stuff. So everything really came together. And I mean, it was hard work. It's just as hard work doing a digital festival as it is a festival in real life. But it's been life-changing to go to put that together.
Amazing. I feel like that was one of the advantages of like lockdown, is that people became available. You didn't have to factor in travel time. You didn't have to factor in where people were based other than with time zones. And that produced some really amazing collaborations. Just when we needed them. And you're like, for those who might not be familiar, you are a total polymath. So you don't just work in tech and music, but you work across different genres of music, classical traditions, pop, club traditions. Like, what do you think all those different perspectives, because you must get kind of windows into all these different quite self-contained worlds. Like, what do you think that gives you?
I think, you know, I'm reflecting everything that excites me. And I feel so fortunate to have experienced so many different types of scenes. And I think, you know, it was interesting. I think of people like David Byrne or Brian Eno or David Bowie, and they just soaked up culture. They were so curious. They were so fascinated with people. And I'm just a lover of people. I'm fascinated by other people's creativity, by how their look, their expression, their sense of humor, you know. Or if you think about someone like Anthony Bourdain in you know, how he traveled the world, tasting food from everybody. And it's just so beautiful how he connects with people. He's just so interested in how people live and how they put things together. And I really resonate to that. I'm just fascinated by people, and it brings me huge amounts of joy. I think it might just be, it might be an inherited thing. You know, my mum's a musician, a respected musician, and she's an expert in the tradition of a poet called Tagore. And I was at a dinner last night and somebody mentioned that they'd met some musicians who knew my mum. And it's like, you know, she's so popular. I was in Hoxton the other day and these like really trendy young people came up to me and were like, oh yeah, we know, we're mates with your dad. It's like, you know, like we recognized you because he never stops talking about you, which is so adorable. But you know, I think I came from a very sociable background and a big family. So there's like a lot of people and a lot of drama to keep on top of. So that's obviously what I've absorbed.
And I wanted to ask you about how your kind of identities interact and your kind of your upbringing and the sort of Asian identity. Like, how does that interact with, say, like your queerness and the way you make music?
Well, I think when you're brought up in between two cultures, you code switch, and I think people code switch naturally between their parents and their friends and their colleagues. So we do that, and it's one of our great social skills as people. But with, you know, growing up in the way that I did, I mean, my parents were more liberal than most, but I'd effectively built an entire identity outside of school, outside of my home life. And I was basically just a master liar. You know, I had this total love life. All South Asian women do this. They lie about their love life. They just have another one because sex is so taboo and intimacy is so taboo. And I had that going on. I had my artist life go on, which I managed to lie very skillfully because I was always staying the night at friends' houses. And I, just had this complete other identity. And I understand why I did that. I also can see why, how I would have put myself in so much danger and why it's unwise for parents, you know, for kids to lie to their parents in that way. But I had to form something of myself. The South Asian culture is very codependent and they don't have a lot of boundaries. And you know, anything around your sexuality or your expression, everything is just in shame and very taboo. And so I rebelled on my own terms by just setting up my own identity. And I don't think my parents fully understand, and I don't think I really want them to understand, but I think they really respect how I just took the reins of my life and have really formed myself. And I also was quite annoying because I did really well. I worked really hard and I did really well at school. So they couldn't tell me off for being naughty.
They couldn't hold that over you.
And that's, especially other South Asian women, they work really hard and they do really well academically. So any of that naughty stuff, it's not even naughty. It's like normal stuff. Having sexual relationships and having partners and finding yourself and being a bit messy, that's not naughty, that is normal. But we're brought up to believe that that's really naughty, which obviously makes it more fun, you know.
Yeah. And whereabouts did you grow up? Were you on the outskirts?
No, I grew up in zone one West London. So I was really lucky. I absorbed a lot of things just through the tube. I could walk through Soho and go, you know, there were lots of record shops and secondhand bookshops where I'd pick up those Taschen books, you know, in the days when, you know, magazines were not commodities, you know, I would read about things in the Melody Maker, the NME, the Face. I remember those Taschen books that were always like a fiver. They were really big. So I'd find out about, you know, queer culture and the fetish scene and Thierry Mugler, Jean-Paul Gaultier. You know, I was thinking about the other day, what are the components that make me up? And it was my obsession with the women of punk and no wave and new wave, the pioneers of electronic music. And that extends to kind of industrial and electronica of all kinds. And then the Sunday magazine supplements, that Isabella Blow style. So I was finding out about the work of Nick Knight. It was all about Alexander McQueen, Jean-Paul Gaultier, John Galliano, you know, these kind of hybrid goddess women with all of this avant-garde stuff. And yeah, of course, like I love the charts as well. So in the charts, you had Bjork and Skunk Anansie and Garbage, and even, you know, some of that Britpop stuff was just like genius, and, you know, in my opinion. So I was lucky to be surrounded by all of that, you know.
It's such a good exercise, like looking back on the kind of culture that built you. And I always think it's interesting, like what's there within, you know, your family home growing up, what's there in the wider culture, and then there are certain things that you just latch onto like a duckling, aren't there, and you can't necessarily explain it, but you're just drawn kind of towards them. But amazing to be like in London as well, like where it was all
I was really lucky. I mean, I went to a really snotty girls' school, and that really affected my self-esteem and my confidence, because it was really based in money, and the snobbery and the status was just pushed into your face. It was absolutely brutal. And I feel a lot of South Asian, a lot of our parents came over here and put us into this kind of exclusive schooling, so we had this extra level of head fuckery, you know. So sorry, I don't know if I can swear, but yeah, like absolute head fuckery, where you're being forced to be schooled in a culture that really doesn't want anything to do with you, but then everyone hates you because you went to the posh school. So it's just all of this, you know. And it absolutely battered and belittled my sense of being. So being adopted by a performance art band called Minty, who was founded by performance artist Lee Bowery, that really helped me. And just being really into music and finding some friends who were into just weirdo music, that has continued to save my life forever, you know.
So yeah, tell me about that, because you kind of fell into the queer club scene as like a young teenager. So yeah, tell me about that and getting involved with Minty and how that all played out.
Yeah, really. Well, it's just really fascinating, because the current queer sphere that we're living in now, and you know, the definitions of gender, the way that language has changed, really all of that was going on. But it, you know, so I met Minty through my boyfriend at the time, who was playing, you know, who'd actually joined them as a member and was doing gigs with them. And yeah, as I say, the reality that we're living in with definitions of gender and trans rights, and, you know, that was all going on. It's just that that was a generation that had survived AIDS. So a lot of my queer elders spent their youth going to, sometimes people would say they would go to a couple of funerals a week. I mean, you know, that like this is a scene of people that had been absolutely battered. You know, they'd been kicked to the ground by the Thatcher government. There was Section 28 lurking around. You know, there was a lot of homophobia at large. And so our families formed through clubs as a way to kind of defend ourselves and as a way to protect ourselves. So what I remember is on the streets is how threatening it was, you know. Now the threats have translated to being online, and there's a lot of online psychological hatred. But back then it was really abrasive and really dangerous. But, you know, I felt very protected. I mean, there was quite, you know, quite extreme, like the sex and drugs and all kinds of rock and roll going on. And yeah, I was very protected by members of the band who were even indulging in like insane behavior themselves. But it was very clear that I was loved and that I was protected. So I saw all kinds of mad shit go on. It's quite tame by today's standards, but it's just a very different world that we live in, you know. It's interesting to watch people who were so at the cutting edge now, in, I guess, in their late 40s, early 50s, completely lose touch with what's going on. And it feels like in queer life, there's such a battle in amongst the people themselves, you know. And I don't remember it being like that, because there really were so few. And you really had to be in the know as to what clubs to go to, what areas to go to. You know, your sense of protection had to be so high because society was so against you. So it's been incredible to see how those issues and that debate has come on front and center, which I think is really positive, even though it's complicated.
Yeah, you're right. Everything has changed so much. And it is interesting to see the people who come along with that, and then the ones who struggle and why that might be. I don't know. I mean, I think you're right about the kind of online hate. There's also been like a really depressing rise in hate crimes, especially it feels like recently. But yeah, I guess against a context which is more culturally kind of accepting broadly of LGBT people. And the age thing about the AIDS crisis, like I was reading the book How to Survive a Plague, which is this amazing history of AIDS activism in the States. And then you'll read about these people doing these amazing things, and then it'll say that they're, you know, they're 18 years old, they're 21, 23. And yeah, that just blows my mind. The weight of that on such young people has the mark that it leaves is just, yeah, incalculable, really.
Yeah, yeah. Let's face it, like, queer people are always salty. They're always rowing with each other. You know, they're always reading each other. It's like a part of the culture. But I think a lot of what I've observed is now I understand that, oh, you know, these people are, you know, a lot of the pain has just got to do with being treated like the absolute scum of scourge of society and just losing hundreds of their friends. And, you know, I think that the scenes of yesteryear were, you know, everything was a lot more extreme, and like people were much more cruel to each other. You know, like they were simultaneously a lot kinder to each other, but a lot more cruel to each other. But I think if you're in a society that damns you constantly, it's very hard to not act up and then not be cruel to one another, you know. And I think that the inequalities still exist, but on a very different plane now. And it makes me very sad that there's a huge disconnect between the scenes and societies. And it's really that there's an entire generation who basically they just hate the internet, and they even like hate people. They hate people like me. They just hate the fact that I'm on Instagram, or, you know, just, people are so annoyed with me. It's so funny. And there's, it's sad that there's a disconnect, that whilst everybody loved It's a Sin, which was a brilliant TV show, they don't realize that a lot of the quote unquote cis white gays that they're angry and annoyed with are that generation. And I feel like there needs to be a bit more of an empathetic dialogue between the two generations.
I hope that that show has opened people's eyes. Like, it really shocked me how, I guess, because I still think of myself as young, even though I'm in my mid-30s, and I forget that there are fully grown adults who are like 15 years younger than me, and they just didn't seem to, some of the comments I saw about the show, they just didn't seem to have a grasp of the timelines, of that it wasn't that long ago, and that the people who went through it are still here. And, you know, yeah, I hope it kind of facilitates more understanding. The other thing I found really interesting is watching, like, if you look through RuPaul's Drag Race and you see the really young contestants in these later seasons, there have been like multiple contestants who just don't seem to have any trauma around their sexuality and have really supportive parents. And it just makes you think, kind of counterfactually, what would the people of the older generations be like? They'd be different people who, if they hadn't been through that. And it's just kind of, it's an amazing signal of hope. And it's also really heartbreaking when I compare like a drag queen like Aquaria, who just seems to just be basically completely fine, super supportive parents, absolutely winning. And you just think that could have been so many more people who have been so affected.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really great thing that there is that generation who are being totally supported. But I definitely know that life is really complicated, and, you know, and yeah, I mean, everybody has their struggles and everybody is going to have their down periods, whoever or whatever you are. Like, it just doesn't matter, you know, it doesn't matter where you're from or how loving your family are. And I think that's what really motivates me to do a lot of mentoring and stuff, is just knowing just how up and down things are and knowing the ebb and flow and the turn of the tide. And that's something that the pandemic should have taught us, that it doesn't matter how great things are going, something can just slap you from the other direction that you had no idea was coming your way. And to develop just empathy and patience.
Definitely, especially with yourself, I think. The other thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of identities in different spaces, you said before, you know, you've been doing music for decades and you're usually the only brown woman in the room. Do you see a difference between straight and queer spaces in the UK, or is that pretty consistent?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really, really good question. I'm involved, I'm on the board of something called the F List, and the F List was set up by a really brilliant woman called Vic Bain to do an audit of women in the music industry. And this was done in like 2019. So in the before times, when you look at the statistics, they are appalling. So I think that there's only 16% of all working female artists have a publishing deal. And I think it's in the 22 to 24% who are actually signed to a label. So in terms of equality, that's, I mean, it's just terrible, isn't it? And obviously that disproportionately affects women of color. And there's a lot of people who are really trying to change, you know, like, people definitely are attempting to change and to redress the balance, but it's just going to take a bit of time. And also we're in this era of Spotify, streaming rights, you know, social media has become big business. It's not free and fun. It's a big game that everybody has to play. That really affects, you know, the artists starting out in their 20s who have to have a new release every 6 weeks because that's what the Spotify algorithm wants. I mean, it's really mad. It's an exciting but very mad time in terms of what is expected of creative people. So I guess, like, I don't really know whether I have any useful answers to this particular question, but it's certainly raising a lot of stuff. I mean, yes, there are programmers and there are curators and there are people really making an effort to be more inclusive. But in terms of the overall outcome, it's still a really long way to go, you know. And, you know, when you look at festival lineups, which is where like the big bucks lies, it just, I don't know, the music industry does a very good job of allowing you to believe that it's super progressive and it just isn't. And I think being honest about it is going to help people a lot more than going, no, everything's great, you know.
Yeah, I think as well is often it's literally just showing people the facts. And I always think when people repost festival posters, but with all the male names stripped off, yeah, and they're just empty, like, yeah, nothing speaks louder than that. The thing that gets me is like, Primavera the other year, they had that amazing commitment to gender equality on their lineup, and the lineup was incredible. Like, the caliber of the artists, it was stacked. And I don't know, this is where I'm just like, I don't get why you wouldn't want that all the time. I don't get why there's this idea that female artists kind of don't sell. And yeah, and I don't know if you followed the sort of Ray, what's been happening with her trying to get her album released.
So fascinating. Oh no, I love Ray. I stan Ray just for having the guts. There was a slight second where I thought, hang on a minute, is this a marketing thing that she's doing? And it's like, oh no, this is for real, you know, just because I understand how labels and how people work. No, she's really like, that was for real. And also I think she's really exposed what goes on in that major label game. I think everybody assumes, oh, if you're signed, it's going to be da 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 da, it's going to be fine. And it's this whole other mind fuck that goes on. It like when you're in the door, it's like, that's when the real work begins. And so it's been extraordinary what she's managed to expose. It's the whole insanity of that bit of the music industry has just been like completely like ripped open, and it's really not working for it, you know. It always finds a way to work for itself, but it's working for artists less and less. So, oh no, I love Ray. I mean, it's stunning woman, and just really brave for doing that. And I really, yeah, I think everyone basically loves her now. You know? I mean, they did anyway, yeah, but everyone loves her even more, you know.
Yeah. But you can just see why she would have got to the end, yeah, of her tether. Like, she has had so many, yeah, hits, you know, if you place her kind of who is one of the most successful kind of chart, yeah, artists in the UK, and she's up there. And if she can't get her album made when I think she's on like a 5, yeah, or 6 album deal, like, yeah, it's crazy. The other thing I find really interesting about women in music, and, you know, with the particular kind of focus of this podcast, is that there's a kind of deification of a lot of female artists by queer men. Like, I was at an amazing gay wedding and all of the tables were named after female celebrities. And it was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. So I wonder if, like, do you think female artists as a rule are kind of more respected by queer men than straight men? But I think that's my hunch is that's probably true. But then are those queer men respected by the mainstream in the industry? Probably not. And so you get kind of people, you know, all the ageism against Cher and Madonna, but they're still selling, yeah, out stadiums. And, you know, that,
yeah,
dynamic.
Yeah, no, that's such a great question. So, you know, the way that queer subcultures worked was it was always queer, you know, like queer people and strong women. And because we were all the outcasts and we carried the charge of being intimidating and threatening, and still to this day, that kind of stigma, those projections of being intimidating and, you know, like all of that societal bias. So everybody just kind of came together. And if you read about certainly the history of the pop and rock industries in the UK, it's really where queer men were doing a lot of the managing. They were behind the scenes, really making it happen, like really making the inner workings of bands happen, because that's where they could hide, you know, and that's where they weren't discriminated against, and they could hide and they could earn money and really, and, you know, show business is typically where queer people went to hide. Because they could just be themselves, you know, without the fear of being outed or, you know, like, you know, yeah, without much fear. And that's where queer people and, you know, quote unquote, straight divas always came together. And so I think a lot of queer men, certainly in the 60s and 70s, were absolutely worshipped, but as long as they kept in the closet. And even in the mid 2000s, with some of the musicians that I was really close to, you know, they were absolutely like bullied into just being in the closet. They were constantly asked to turn their campness down. You know, it's been really interesting to watch an artist like Harry Styles and exactly the same style, you know, the techniques that they're using to market him, you know, 10, 12 years earlier, were completely denied to people that I know who were on the same label. You know, they were asked to just shut their mouths and turn it down and, you know, not talk about their sexuality, not talk about what they were going through. It was a very taboo, you know, the 2000s, it's interesting. Now people are reappraising it and going, oh my God, it was this really shocking time. And it's like, no, it wasn't, because there was also an underground where we all hid. There was a mainstream that was like kind of gross, but I watched all the TV shows anyway. And then there was an underground of like Electro Clash and, you know, journalist Daisy Jones has written a book about gay and bisexual and queer women in the 2000s. And there's actually, she's written a beautiful, beautiful portion of one of the chapters about me and my life. And because Daisy grew up in East London, she knows how many of the venues have all been shut down after the big crash of 2008. And so we were all just happily living, like literally on the underground of, you know, like in, you know, within the subcultures of London that all the weirdos and freaks could escape to. And then smartphones changed all of that, and social media went up to sort of 10 notches into the reality that we're in now. There's tons about that I love. But yeah, it's interesting to see how everything that was so underground and so taboo then comes back as the main way that certain artists are being marketed and sold. But I guess that's just the way the cookie crumbles. I'm, you know, for me, I think it's important that a lot of my designer friends and choreographer friends, that people are just getting work and they're getting interesting projects, you know, like that's what's important to me now.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, as you say, like it was a very, like, I guess, a subculture where you had to be there, and it was around venues and being in the same place, and you would be drawn in and you would physically be there. And social media, like, A, allows the creators to say what they like Ray used Twitter, and like I'm thinking of like Lil Nas X and the way that he does what he wants and is able to speak about it directly, and then fans can also connect with that wherever they are. But yeah, I know what you mean. It's kind of mad how things move, and how things being in a different format make it easier for artists, or like you say, maybe cynically labels are like, oh, everyone's ready now, you know, 20 years later, the mainstream is ready. And this is actually like an aspirational thing. And like looking to the future. So tell me about your music that you've got coming up.
So I am releasing my third studio album called Let My Country Awake. And it was written by me and it was produced by me and a really amazing producer based in Bushwick, Brooklyn, called Jeff Cook. Jeff Cook's also a very accomplished composer and just like all round music magic man. And it was commissioned by an art space in Brooklyn called National Sawdust. And the album is part inspired by a collection of essays called The Good Immigrant. And the title track is from the Tagore poem, Let My Country Awake, which was written in the wake of the British Empire leaving India. And it's an album which is there again, exploring my thoughts and ideas around, I forget the word, but yeah, like just around culture and around borderless identity. And I'm also thinking a lot about the general, you know, anti-racism and what does it mean to have a borderless identity in music, in art? I mean, ultimately, being a creative person is to be borderless and, you know, is to be genderless. And the album, I've sampled some interviews from three of the Good Immigrant writers. So that's Nikesh Shukla, Selena Godden and Darren Chetty. And we'll be launching it in mid-October. I can't quite say where yet, but there will be a big live launch in mid-October. And the live show is a live coded light show with a duo called Output Arts, who I've been collaborating with very closely for the last 5 years. And yeah, the first single comes out this Friday, the 20th of August, and there'll be simultaneous releases up through till November. So I'm very excited and nervous.
Amazing. Yeah. I love that book. I love that essay collection. And all of the like second lives it's having, because I think there's been an American edition of the book and now you're kind of reinterpreting it through music. So
yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, thank you. I'm really nervous as hell. But you know, I've also come through you know, what it means to be an indie artist, what it means to be, you know, yeah, like an independent creator on the internet. And it's full on, but I'm really enjoying it.
That is a good position to be in, I think, to land up at. And finally, what I ask everyone is to nominate another Dorothy who I should profile on the podcast.
I nominate Hannah Holland, who was DJing at Margate Pride. She is a DJ, composer, producer. She composed the soundtrack to Adult Material last year on Channel 4. She's also been incredibly active on the queer scene for the past, you know, 20 odd years. She had an incredible club in the mid-2000s called Bastard Batty Bass, and then set up Batty Bass Records. We were all a part of the same scene, but in terms of, you know, a DJ, film composer, a label boss, she came from a background of filmmaking, and I think she made some videos for Golf Rap. Do check me on that, because I might just be making that up. But in terms of somebody who is just lovely and has been just such an advocate and such a cool, lovely, mega talented woman who's really been around the queer scene and can probably give an even more of a depth into its evolution and also a different depth from me, I'd absolutely nominate her. She's a boss.
Can you put us in touch?
I will do.
Whatever Bishy does next, you don't want to miss it. We're so happy to be back on your feeds and in your ears, so please don't forget to rate us 5 stars, as we think this series of podcasts has some important stories that need to be heard. As ever, don't forget to tweet us and let us know what you thought of the episode and which Dorothy you think I should talk to next. On the next episode, we're talking about sexuality and faith, specifically Christianity, with the brilliant Lisa Jane Lewis. This episode of The Dorothy Project featured Bishy as our guest. It was hosted by Alice Beverton Palmer and produced by Laura Blake.